My castaway this week is an academic and author. He was born and brought up in poor working class conditions in Leeds. His father died when he was very small, and he came home one day to find his mother dead from TB. Nevertheless, he went on to university and into academic life, experiences which prompted him to write nearly 40 years ago now an enormously influential book called The Uses of Literacy. Its thesis that the working class want more and deserve better in educational and cultural terms than society chooses to give them has accompanied him ever since. As Professor of English at Birmingham University, as Assistant Director General of UNESCO, and as the Warden of Goldsmiths College in London, he's waged a ceaseless battle against a society founded on popular consumerism, what he's described as the corrupt brightness of mass entertainments, a world in which progress is conceived as a seeking of material possessions and freedom as the ground for endless, irresponsible pleasure. He is Richard Hoggart. When you warned of those influences, Richard Hoggart, back in the 50s, the worst examples you could quote of them then were The Gang Show and Titbits and The Daily Mirror. And now, of course, there's a plethora of such stuff about us. You must feel entirely defeated.
No, I don't feel defeated. I feel depressed, but I'm depressed by the weight of the material that's coming on now. I mean, I wrote before television, and if you look at the worst of television, and I believe it's getting worse all the time, then it reinforces, I'm sorry to say, what I was saying all those years ago. It's a curious kind of balancing act. On the one hand, there is massively more tripe for most people, which I'm afraid they consume because it's tasty, like a hamburger. And the better provision for the 10% who are educated as people in a democracy should be is in a way a spin-off of the larger poor provision for the masses. It's a product of technology. It's a product of communications technology.
So the people, you're saying the people at the bottom of the pile are as ill-served as ever?
Rather more ill-served. There are many things that are good. Most people are we have a great many people who are on the streets and who are living on social security, but by and large, most people have more money, they eat.
They travel more, they know more about other people around the world.
Yes, they travel more, and they travel to the great honeypots, and that travel is often enough to depress anyone. Do you know that in the Costa Brava, at the cheapest hotels, at the end of a week, usually with British working class people, they pull out the bits of furniture and hose the room down. That's really a shocking thought.
I don't think the consumer himself, the ordinary man who goes to the Costa Brava, comes home feeling depressed. I think he comes home feeling he's had a nice time, doesn't he?
Possibly, yes.
What's wrong with it?
Well, what's wrong with it is that there are nice times which are bad for you and nice times which are good for you. See, I realise as I get older and older and older that I am an old Puritan moralist. And
your critics say you're elitist, don't they?
Elitism is a dirty word nowadays. If you say, look, in spite of everything, and it's a pity that most people don't read George Eliot, she is nevertheless the greatest of English novelists, women or men, you're not making an elitist remark, you're making a judgment which you're prepared to substantiate. And I say that. And if to be an elitist means that you say some things are better than others, yes, I'm an elitist. But that's a good word, not a dirty one.
Right. I want to talk much more about it, but first of all, I want to explore you on this desert island. Tell me about your first record and why you'd need it.
Yes, the first one is a record by Ella Fitzgerald. It's a depression song, not a depressing song. My wife and I, we were courting at the university at the time in Leeds. We first heard it then. It's a lovely, defiant, cocking a snoot, turning your thumb in your nose at the upper classes as they think themselves. And so it's one of the first songs I remember, which is not only witty and bouncy, and we used to bounce up the road back home after the library closed singing it, but it's the first one which gave me a kind of invigorative sense that one can go into the whole class business with a great cheerfulness.
Let's go slumming, take me slumming. Let's go slumming on Park Avenue. Glasses and make faces when a member of the classes passes.
Ella Fitzgerald and Slumming on Park Avenue. Let's come at your thesis, Richard Hoggart, from another angle, if I can, because it seems to me, if I understand it aright, that one of the fundamental messages was that the working classes of which you wrote were and are naturally more discerning than the ruling classes allowed for, that they don't just swallow whole what they're fed, that they can make judgments on what they're getting.
That's true. That's to say, they do have very strong resistances. They have a kind of gravity which makes them bite a coin twice before they buy it, as it were. There's a lot of that built in. My argument would be that this is being gradually eroded because the pressures are so very strong the other way.
So it's a drip, drip, drip effect.
There's a drip effect. And nobody ever knows that they've been affected. There's a lovely cartoon from the New Yorker where two people are sitting saying, everybody's saying that we're being made into apes by telly, but it never happens, and they're watching telly, and when you look at the back of their heads, they've got the heads of apes. It's a nice little point.
Now, you felt and feel all these things very deeply because you are a working-class boy yourself. You were brought up in the back streets of Leeds, but obviously you had a first-class brain. Did that make you very unhappy as a child? Did you feel even then these kind of frustrations? Did you sense the limitations of your upbringing?
When you're, I suppose, up to 12 or 13, you don't notice. You're naturally happy, cheerful, you're in good health.
Because you don't know anything else?
No. And I was the only kid in the district who went to, I was the first boy ever to go to grammar school from that slum school. The boys laughed at me a bit, but they didn't dislike me. They threw my cap off every day, so I put it in my pocket. But they weren't.
They thought you were a swot, didn't
well,
they?
Well, there's a swot, yes, and going to grammar school with a funny hat on. But it was all right. I didn't share their pastimes, but no, I never felt that.
But
no.
You didn't have parents. As I said, your parents had died when you were about eight, and
yes.
You went to live in what you've described as a very unhappy household.
It was basically unhappy. There was my grandmother, who had 10 children, and three of them, unmarried, were in their 40s and were living with her, and that's a recipe for unhappiness. There was an aunt who had a violent temper. Oof. I still think of it, and she was the oldest. She could make a row out of anything. And there was a much tenderer, softer aunt who was very nice, but she was no match for the first aunt. And there was an uncle who took to the bottle. And this was a great recipe, as I say, for a Saturday night barge-up, because he'd come back rolling drunk and the first aunt would go for him, and, oh, it was terribly unhappy. But in the middle of it was my grandmother, who was pushing 80, sitting in an armchair, sort of agonisingly rubbing her hands together, because she was made unhappy by it. But she loved me dearly, and that she was a still focus of love. For me, as a child, I think I would have had a hard time surviving without being unhappy if I hadn't known that in that armchair by the side of the fire there was this figure who exuded love. And so it's like everything else in life, it was a mixture.
Tell me about record number two.
It was a bookless home. That's obvious. It was also a musicless home. We didn't have a radio till, I don't know when, very late anyway. But somebody gave me a wind-up gramophone, and I took it up to the attic, and a few days later I bought for, I don't know, threepence or something, an old record. And it turned out to be the prelude to Traviata, and it's the sort of music that this soft-hearted aunt of mine always referred to as, she used to say, it's music which makes you want to give all your money away. And since she'd never had anything in her life, it was a very meaningful sentence.
Prelude to Verdi's La Traviata, played by the Tokyo Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Roberto Paternostro. You've made a remark before now that it's almost always the women in working-class life who see and encourage academic potential. Why is that?
The women were much more important. The archetype of this is Mrs. Morell in Lawrence's Sons and Lovers, of course. They were in the middle of the household. They managed the money, and managing money in a working-class household is an economic miracle almost. The husbands tended to be, not, of course, there were some very good husbands, but they tended to be somewhat feckless or to be a bit tricky about the booze. And so it had become a tradition in those districts that the woman was the focal point. She made the decisions, and it was almost always that the wife, either with or without the husband's consent, said, well, if he's clever, he must go on.
You mentioned Sons and Lovers, and somebody has compared you to D.H. Lawrence before now as being, as you've described him, a good, decent person. Is that kind of how you see yourself? Do you like the comparison?
I don't like to be called a good, decent person, because I know I'm not, and we all know what our sins are. But I love the word decent, because I think it's a word which you have to fight hard to give any meaning to today. Because
but that's what you're stressing, isn't it? The decency of those working classes, the decency of your grandmother and other people around you. I mean, there was a decent headmaster in your life, wasn't there? People who were willing to give you a leg up.
Yes, that's true. There was the headmaster who bullied the local education authority to let me go to grammar school.
Why did they need bullying? Did you fail the 11
plus? Well, I failed the 11 plus because they'd never taught me maths. And he was an old man, and he went down to the office in Leeds and said, this boy's written this essay, give him a scholarship. And either they read it and said, hey, this is a bright lad, or they said, he's an old man, he's nearly retiring, let him have at least one scholarship. So I went anyway. And there the English master got hold of me, and tells you such a lot about grammar schools in those days. In my third year, he pointed out of the window, the upstairs window of the school, across Leeds, where the posh areas are, and he said, if you play your cards right, Hoggart, you can live in Roundy. You see, well, I don't live in Roundy. But that was his...
You live in Farnham,
well,
which is...
I live in Farnham, which is worse.
Is it?
That soft, lovely aunt of mine married a widowed miner with six children, and she became the focus of that household, and she had a happy life after that, generally speaking. And I went to the Working Men's Club with her and her husband. It was a club in near Castleford. And there was a big miner there sitting next to me drinking, and he kept saying, hey, you must be clever, because I was at grammar school. I think I was at university then. And every time he got a drink, he passed me half a crown. And that was a lot of money, £2 or £3 now. And I said...
More,
perhaps, yes. I got very embarrassed, and he said, hey, lad, don't you bother, I'll only waste it. Miners do, but you can make good use of it. And so I had a pocket full of half crowns by the end of the evening.
Record number three.
Well, that's Castleford, the mining area outside Leeds, where this aunt of mine went with her husband and the six kids. And it's also a very interesting thing about English leisure, which I'm fascinated by. I mean, the English are the most leisure-taking and inventing people anywhere in the world, I think. And the leisure is often very eccentric and baroque. They love dressing up, especially men dressing up as women. And this song by Jake Thackeray, who went to the same university as I did, is part of... It's not dressing up, it's dressing down, because they strip off. But I always remember this aunt of mine who had 11 children. She had a son who used to saw his wife in half every weekend at the working men's clubs. And he got his mother to go one day to see him in action, and she was preceded by a stripper. Now, this aunt with 11 kids was extremely puritanical, and I thought she'd be outraged, but she wasn't. She came back and she said, you know, she took everything off, and all she'd got left were three tassels. And I thought, what's coming next? And she said, but you wouldn't believe what she could do with them tassels. So, now, this is a Jake Thackeray talking about the Castleford, that's the mining town, Castleford Ladies' Magic Circle. And it's very interesting. It's not a mocking song. It's a very affectionate song.
Their husbands potter at snooker down the club, unaware of the devilish jiggery poke and rub-a-dub-dub, while Elizabeth Jones and Lily O'Grady and three or four more married ladies are frantically dancing naked for Beelzebub. And after the witch's picnic and the devil's grog, after their savage pantings, their hysterical leapfrog, well, Elizabeth Jones and Lily O'Grady and three or four more married ladies go back home for cocoa and the epilogue.
Jake Thackeray and the Castleford Ladies' Magic Circle. So Richard Hoggart, a scholarship to Leeds University, a first in English, and then the Army. 1940, the Royal Artillery. You didn't fit in, did you?
Well, I suppose I didn't. When we had the passing out parade, the colonel shouted from the rostrum, "Lose that man, he's congenitally incapable of being in step," which I thought was a very nice remark.
But the forces reinforced your view about society class-ridden, didn't it?
Yes, they were. I hope they've changed a bit. The point was that the army was expanding very quickly, and therefore the officers tended to become quickly, first of all, the old territorial army people. They were immensely conventional. They weren't bad-tempered, but they were very conventional, and they hadn't asked a question to save their lives. But there was another bunch who were the new ones. That's people like me who'd been drafted in because they needed officers. And you always found some whom you could get on with.
So you saw action in Italy. And you got married, I think, in 42. And then after the war, babies began. And you took a teaching post in adult education. And then it was during those years, the second half of the 40s and early 50s, that you began to develop the idea for this book, The Uses of Literacy. Now, I wonder why that happened then. After all, it was a very frugal time. There were few cars, few televisions. I mean, a long-distance telephone call was a kind of major event in one's life, wasn't it? Why did you spot this consumerism coming?
Immediately after the war, a whole group of us went into adult education, university adult education, because that was expanding. And we all went in teaching our subject, and we were immediately faced with an extraordinary discrepancy between the academic view of our subject, which we were taking out extramural beyond the walls, and the lives of the people we were persuading in the evenings to come and listen to us for 2 hours or so, or talk to us. And you tried to write about that. That's what I was writing about. That book began as a textbook on how to read popular newspapers and women's magazines.
But it ended up being all about you as well and your life.
It ended because the second half was written first, the textbook bit. And then I thought, I can't do this, it's snobbish, just to look at these things, tidbits of women, as though you had a peg on your nose while she held them up. The first half of the Uses of Literacy was my attempt to come to terms with not being snooty about the stuff people read and setting it in its context and saying, all right, this stuff is pretty trivial, but the people who, as it were, look at it, read it, are not themselves trivial. They do things with it.
And it made your name overnight.
There was no great fuss because we were in America when it came out. It had been an expensive business. The pay in America was so poor that we had to use what bit we had in the bank. But I came back to the first royalty payments, which I think were all of about £700. And that made us just right. We could buy another car and set up the house again. But I got a lot of invitation after that.
Including to give evidence for the defence of Lady Chatterley's lover, which I want to ask you about in a minute. But tell me first about your next record.
It's Jacqueline Dupré playing that cello concerto, which is a famous recording, of course. I'm very interested in television, and there's a certain snootiness about music on television. There is a television film of Jacqueline Dupré, and when it reaches this point in the concerto, they move in, the cameras move in, and it struck me enormously powerfully that what you see there is a human brain which has recorded all that. She's not watching, she doesn't have a score. That brain is pushing this stuff out through her imagination and her heart and all that, all the organs of feeling she has, whatever they are. And you can see it going through her arms and her hands, through the bow onto the cello. It's an extraordinary instance of totally absorbed creativity by an artist. And at that moment, when I was watching it at home, I thought, well, without television, one could simply not see this happening at all. And that is a great gift.
Thank you. part of Elgar's cello concerto played by Jacqueline Dupré with the Philadelphia Orchestra conducted by Daniel Barenboim. So it was 1960 and you were given a walk-on part in the Lady Chatterley trial. You've said that you were a sort of Ebar Gum figure. What do you mean when you say that?
They were very clever, the solicitors for Allen Lane. They decided not to bring on all sorts of arty bohemian types like Kenneth Tynan and so on, and they were looking around for different types. And I think I was the provincial lecturer, a sort of plain man's D.H. Lawrence or something of that sort. And when I got there, the solicitors told me to dig my heels in because they just made one of the witnesses cry, a woman. He was a nasty man. Griffith Jones is dead now. And he tried to patronise me. You come from Leicester as though he was dropping a dead cat in your lap, you know. But the great moment was when he kept reading what he conceived as dirty bits. And would I say that that wasn't dirty? Was it virtuous? And I sort of pushed the boat out without thinking and said, I would say, in fact, it's puritanical. And the moment I said it, I knew that I'd really given an enormous hostage to fortune. And the great moment came afterwards, the next day, when E.M. Forster was called in, and this little man in a clean Macintosh, very old, well over 80 or something like that, and Jeremy Hutchinson, the number two in our defence case, took a very bold gamble. He said, "Mr. Forster, a previous witness has said that this book, far from being obscene, is indeed virtuous and puritanical." Puritanical is an odd word. What do you think? And I thought, if Forster says, well, that's a load of old rubbish, I'll go through the floor. In fact, Forster looked up at the sky and said, "It may at first seem rather paradoxical, but on reflection, I think it could be regarded as just." And I thought, there's the boy. That was wonderful, you see.
They said you turned the trial.
Well, that's what they said. I think it was turning anyway.
Record number 5.
That phase of our lives after Chatterley and when we were moving across Birmingham, and it's the period at the turn into the 60s. Our children were in their teens. They hadn't fled the nest. And one thing they did, of course, was to play records very loudly. And one of them amused me no end. It was Clarence Frogman Henry singing "But I Do."
I don't know why I love you, but I do. I don't know why I cry so, but I do. I only know I'm lonely, and that I want you only. I don't know why I love you, but I do.
Clarence Frogman Henry, "And I Don't Know Why I Love You, But I Do." So, a Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies, it was your invention, 1962, it was a term that didn't exist before then. This was presumably a continuation of what you've been talking about, your desire to build a bridge, as it were, between academic study and culture in the general sense, yes?
Yes. The idea is to look at many of the phenomena of modern life, newspapers, women's magazines, popular novels, cartoons, and popular songs, all the great massive phenomena of modern life, and to understand them better. That was one of the core ideas. The other was, for me, it wasn't for others who came along, was that one way of understanding these things was to apply to them your methods of literary criticism, which you put into studying Hardy. It was language used in a certain way, and structures and symbols and images and myths, and you could apply these methods which you'd been trained in traditional English studies. So that was it.
And it certainly worked. I mean, it took off. It swept the world, really, this whole concept of cultural studies, isn't it?
They're all over. The trouble is I don't understand a lot of them now. they've moved over into a great deal of theory, either Marxist very often or Marxian, plus Gramsci, and all these constructionists and so on.
But that's my point, really. I mean, in a sense, it's been hijacked, hasn't it? It's been hijacked. It's become overtly political.
It isn't that they've hijacked it, it's that they've fallen in love with theory. It's like having a waffle iron, and you shove this waffle iron on top of the material and say, that fits, but to make it fit, you have to chop bits off it. So,
But it must be saddening, because these are the kinds of people who are, as we were saying earlier on, attempting to equate Middlemarch with EastEnders or the Beatles with Beethoven, and saying that you can compare these things, that there is no such thing as great art and great literature and great pieces of music.
You see, what happens if they use the theory like that and if they say that everything is grist to our mill? They end by being totally relativist, and that's a disaster.
You've called them moral cretins.
Yes. No, I didn't call them moral cretins. That's wonderful. No, a chap came along and said, not me, I don't want your neighbours now, he said a lot of people in modern cultural studies are moral cretins. I think that's extravagant. They aren't moral cretins. But what he's pointed is something important, that they're afraid of making moral judgments.
Record number 6.
Auden, W.H. Auden, has been one of my favourites ever since I was a young man. Still is. He's as obsessed as I am, for that matter, come to it. He was when he wrote this poem, about the fact that this century has been, I suppose, one of the worst centuries ever. I mean, you think of the Holocaust, you think of what's going on now in what was Yugoslavia. The sheer capacity for inhumanity and heartlessness is quite terrifying. And this poem of Auden, The Shield of Achilles, is about those who become the victims of that and for whom a force which they don't understand and which is entirely inhumane towards them just does away with them. That's the people being executed at the beginning. And then towards the end, he looks at a group of urchins and says, these are urchins in modern life who, as it might be, the inhabitants of the inner cities, who have no sense of belonging to one another at all, and there is no love anywhere. It's a very sad poem, but very powerful.
A ragged urchin, aimless and alone, loitered about that vacancy. A bird flew up to safety from his well-aimed stone. That girls are raped, that two boys knife a third, were axioms to him, who had never heard of any world where promises were kept, or one could weep because another wept.
W. H. Auden reading an extract from his poem The Shield of Achilles. You've been married, Richard Hoggart, to the same woman for 53 years, your wife Mary. You've had 3 children. I wonder, in the light of the deprivations of your childhood, which you described, I wonder what kind of father you've been.
I remember the younger boy, once asking me for extra pocket money to buy some stamps, and I gave him some. I'm a bit soft, I should say, as a father. That's one consequence, as my wife will tell you. But then he came again, and I said to him, come on, Paul, you can't. This is the third time you've come. And he said, I've looked in your wallet. You've got some pound notes there. And I said, yes, and I gave him a little lecture on how it's all accounted for. You know, this is for that, that's for food and so on. And he said, look, come on, forget the back streets of Leeds and just give me the money. Which I thought was at least a sign that he'd not been overborne by me.
And what about as a grandfather? Are you an even nicer grandfather?
As usual, yeah. That's what grandfathers are, isn't it? But again, I look at them and love them all very dearly indeed and wonder how they're going to go along. Try not to interfere.
What about you yourself? You've written before now that you've served on all these committees and things, an enormous number of them, because you've always found you were unnaturally glad to be wanted.
Yes, I think that's true. Because I was an orphan, because I was outside, and because, indeed, people with my background, you tend to be treated rather snootily sometimes by some people. I mean, they say to you, if they've discovered you've written something, what college were you? And they just mean Oxford or Cambridge, you see. And I say Leeds. I am very, very thin-skinned about slights like that. Slights to do with snobbery. And I think, therefore, I was pleased to be on various committees, to be asked to be on them.
Record number 7.
After that Auden poem, which almost makes me cry every time I hear it, and he reads it so well, I feel myself pretty well in the depths because it's so true. And then you bounce back and you think, well, there is more to life than that. There's love and there's affection, there's loyalty and fidelity and neighbourliness and all that. And when I think of that, I think of Beethoven's Fidelio and that great, marvellous tune when the prisoners are let out from their underground prisons. It's a movement from despair to hope. So more than anything, to oppose, as it were, in however provisional way, the truth behind the Shield of Achilles of Auden, I would want to hear Fidelio.
part of the Prisoner's Chorus from Act One of Beethoven's Fidelio with the orchestra and chorus of the Vienna State Opera, conducted by Christopher von Dohnányi. Our papers, according to you, are full of increasing vulgarity. We enjoy what you call a lot of rubbish. Is there any hope for us? I mean, can we be rescued from this despair?
There's always hope, and there are a lot of people who give you hope, whatever they are, whether they're educated people or not. But they're all fighting against the sheer weight of this. What is triviality for commercial reasons? You really have to come back and say simple things. And if you put the most important cultural elements in a society into the hands of commercial people who want to make a profit, they will bring it down to the lowest common denominator. It's their nature. They can't help it.
But I go back to the point I made to you earlier. What happened to your faith in the people? You know, your belief that we know innately that there is such a thing as great literature. We know innately when there is quality, and we know when we're eating rubbish. Can't we bounce back against it?
Well, I hope so. I'll do a bit of bouncing myself, but I think that the situation now, in a world in which at every level, whether at high intellectual levels or others, where we're told that nothing is better than anything else, there'll be much less disposition to bounce back. I think what Forster and Auden call the ironic points of light in society, they're being squeezed all the time, but they have to fight back, they have to argue against it, they have to say, this is balls, this is nonsense, this is trash. You can't do it by legislation, but you can stand up and say nuts to you. And I trust the capacity for people to say nuts to that. It's a good British spirit.
Last record.
The Beethoven, the Fidelio, was the great musical expression of the fact that against everything one hopes. Larkin, Philip Larkin, in that lovely poem, An Arundel Tomb, and surprisingly enough, says something similar in poetry instead of in music. I'm surprised at that because he was a very dour and rather pessimistic and sad man throughout his life. Whether he believed what he was saying there, I don't know. I'd like to think he believed it, and I'd like to think I believe it. Otherwise, chaos has come again, and it's all empty. It's one of the great moments where you say, well, against everything, there is love. And whatever happens after that, I don't know. And this is why the Larkin poem is so often quoted, because at the end he brings out that marvellous phrase, what will survive of us is love. I don't know if it's true, but I'll certainly buy it.
Time has transfigured them into untruth. The stone fidelity they hardly meant has come to be their final blazon and to prove our almost instinct almost true. What will survive of us is love.
Philip Larkin reading part of his poem, An Arundel Tomb. If you could only take one of those records, which one would it be?
Oh, that was a problem. It would be either the Elgar or the Beethoven. But I think, English or not, it would have to be the Beethoven.
And Shakespeare and the Bible are there. What extra book would you like to take?
I'd like to take the Complete Essays of Montaigne. He's a wonderful mixture of the dry and the serious and the comical. He's extremely compact and he's very weighty. I remember one passage where he says, when I play with my cat, I wonder whether I'm playing with her or she with me. It's a curious, mad, surrealist thought.
And what about your luxury?
Well, if the first thought was a lot of paper and a pen, but a fountain pen, not a ball pen. And then I thought that probably a lot of people opt for that. It's probably a bit routine. So I'll go for one of those nice bird feeders which have a cage outside to keep squirrels out. I've got one at home and it brings in things like nuthatches. And heaven knows what it would bring on a desert island.
Richard Hoggart, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.